أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. أشهد أن
Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. We're back for another episode of Islam in Focus. We're glad that you could join us. We're continuing with our series dealing with the sources of Islam. We have our fourth program today dealing with Quranic sciences. We'll be discussing or continuing our discussion of the Meccan and Medinan revelations. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining in the program Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University.
Brother Jamal,
assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
We had a very interesting program last time when we began our discussion of the Meccan and Medinan revelations. I wonder if perhaps I could ask you just to quickly highlight what we touched on in that program.
Sure. We continue, first of all, giving some examples about the importance of understanding the reasons for revelation in tying the various passages or various parts of the chapter in the Quran. And then we indicated that the fact that the verse may have a given reason for revelation does not mean that its rule apply only to that incident, but it is general in application. That is, it applies to any similar case regardless. We also indicated that the reason why the Quran, or why God chose that style in the Quran, probably is to make the teaching of the Quran not just dogmatic or list of beliefs, but rather something which is tied and related to the lives of people, their real problems and their practical questions and concerns. And we indicated that this will help in understanding the Quran properly. Then we started with the other aspect, which is very much tied with the reasons for revelation, the distinction, as you said, between the Meccan and Medinan revelation. You indicated essentially that the Quran was revealed over 23 years in piecemeal, but that the first 13 years of revelation took place in Mecca, which was mainly a period of persecution of Muslims. The other 10 years were in Medina, where they began to establish an Islamic community. And we said that this is very helpful in understanding the gradual process of revelation. We also indicated that the main criteria for distinction between the two types of revelations relate to the place, that is where the verse was revealed, or the time, that is whether before or after the migration of the Prophet, or the nature of people, or the type of people who are addressed in these verses, whether the Meccan people are addressed or the Medinite people. And then we indicated that while these three criteria may overlap and might perhaps be the same in some respect, but the most helpful perhaps is the subdivision by the time, that is prior to migration,
yes,
and after migration from Mecca to Medina. But in addition to that, we said that some Muslim scholars have also paid attention to other criteria which are more detailed and interesting observations pertaining to what was revealed at night, what was revealed in the day, winter, summer. So they were really quite careful in trying to trace the various circumstances surrounding the revelation of any particular verse, which is very helpful in understanding the Quran. We give a few examples of that, and I might conclude by saying that despite all of these interesting reports, it is unfortunate that many Orientalists seem to totally discount or disregard these reports in favor of their own speculation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if I could get you to comment on that that point, an experiencing point, that in spite of the massive evidence and the meticulous research and so on, as you say, the Orientalists still don't accept these reports related to the authenticity of the Quran. Why do you think that is?
Well, if the problem was simply a concern for authenticity,
yes,
and verification, one would not blame them. In fact, Muslim scholars themselves were very, very meticulous about that, and they did not just accept any historical report without some verification, as indicated before, both examination of the narrator as well as the analysis of the story itself and how whether there is any flaw in that story. So the the Muslim scholars were just as careful also in terms of the poets. I'm not saying all of them, and there's no flow whatsoever. I mean, humans are humans, but I don't think this is the reason why Orientalists discounted that, because there were many good and authentic reports that they also wholesale rejected, you know. What is questionable, however, in the attitudes of some Orientalists, as Dr. Subhi Saleh indicates, is that some of them, like I said, totally discount all these authentic reports and replace it simply with their own speculation and assumptions, as did Blacher, for example. But on the other hand, we find that some of them go to the other extreme, like Grimm, for example, H. Grimm, G-R-I-M-M-E, like Grimm, to some degree, William Muir also, who go to the other extreme by accepting some weak reports without, application of this skill of verification that Muslim scholars have been particularly, you know, skillful at. And again, base all kind of fantastic results on those weak or less authentic type of reports. So it's the problem of going to either extreme rather than being careful in explaining or verifying any report. It appears, according to Dr. Saleh, that many Orientalists were influenced by the famous Orientalist Noldike, who held the view that the Quran should be ordered in a way that is different from the Islamic methodology. And in other words, he starts aside from any merit to the method that were used, the method that was used by Muslim scholars. He simply said, no, we should reject that altogether and find some other methods. And many just seem to have followed suit without really finding out whether this basic position is justifiable or not. Now, what we said before is basically is that, for example, you can verify if the report has come through an eyewitness to the Prophet, like the companions, and how the report reached us, whether the chain of narration is all trustworthy. And it might be useful here to mention something that we mentioned before, that some companions of the Prophet, like Ibn Mas'ud and Ali, clearly stated that they have a great deal of wealth of information as to the reason for the revelation of the various verses in the Quran. So, and the circumstances, you know, why they were revealed. So, this is the problem actually with the Orientalists.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the verification aspect.
I see. Yeah. Well, does that mean that Muslim scholars were reluctant to express opinion or apply some judgment?
Not necessarily, because even if the if there is an authentic report, if you will, which is the basis for their conclusion, that authentic report also is subject to interpretation, is subject to analysis, and also application of some learned judgment, if you will. But that's different from saying, I'll discount, I don't care about any historical report, no matter how authentic, and I'll just replace that totally with judgment. So in other words, judgment is okay, opinion is fine, but expressed also within the proper context, without neglecting available documents. Because that would be just as deficient as jumping to conclusions on the basis of either weak evidence or just sheer speculation. And since the both elements of judgment and analysis were included, actually, in the research done by Muslim scholars, we find that the most obvious manifestation of this judgmental and analytical freedom that they used is that we find that they differ in some issues pertaining to what is Meccan and Medinite type of revelation. Mind you, some of those differences might be possibly reconcilable, but that shows again that to use carefully authentic historical reports does not mean that you just take it blindly or you don't apply any judgment or analysis. Both are related.
Well, could you give us some examples perhaps to illustrate the this point about
the kind of difference,
the kind of differences that exist?
Well, as Manna al-Qattan, for example, for one scholar, indicate that there is basically about 82, some believe more, 82 chapters out of the 114 chapters of the Quran. At least that number is agreed to among scholars to be revealed in Mecca. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there is also general agreement that a minimum of 20, some believe more even than that, 20 chapters in the Quran were revealed in Medina. And then a maximum really of 12 chapters, or the 12 remaining chapters, could be less depending of course on the other classification, but maximum of 12 chapters in the Quran. There is some difference of opinion among jurists, even though there might be some reports as to whether these chapters were revealed in Mecca or Medina. So that again is one illustration of their freedom to interpret, given even the available reports to them. As indicated also in the previous series on the authority of the Quran, we have seen again that many times you have a chapter which was revealed in Mecca, but in the middle there are a few verses revealed in Medina, because the chapter was not revealed all at once, you know, different periods of time. Similarly, there were chapters revealed in Medina, but they also contain some passages that were revealed in Mecca. So as we mentioned before, the opinions about which verses were the different ones might be generally accepted, but it's not necessarily 100% agreement. And that again shows that judgment, analysis, difference of opinion also was used alongside with the available reports, but not in place of the reports. It could be a matter of interpretation, a matter of giving more weight to one report vis-a-vis the other. This example shows that many Muslim scholars were quite careful, were not simply collectors, automatic mechanical collectors of anecdotes. As far as the question of reconcilability, I mentioned also that some of the differences actually could be reconciled. It might get slightly technical, but I try to make it very simple, really. We mentioned, for example, before that the basis for subdivision of the Meccan and Medinite revelation could be either the time when it was revealed or the place where it was revealed. Many times they might be the same thing, at times they are not necessarily the same thing. So reconcilability here refers to the methodology used by different scholars. One scholar might divide it or classify strictly by the place of revelation, the other by the time. Yes. And obviously they will come up with different classification. Mm-hmm. Not because there is any major problem, but simply because the methodology of classification varies. But even if this is not the case, if it cannot be reconciled in that particular manner, we find that the difference could be really more of a semantical problem than a real hard core type, a substantial type of difference. I'll give you an example of this. In both Bukhari and Muslim, they narrated through Aisha, the wife of the Prophet, that the first thing that was revealed was the beginning of chapter 96, Iqra, or recite. This is very, very widely accepted. There's hardly any difference in that. But again, to show the meticulous honesty of Muslim narrators passed down to the various centuries, we find that in the same reference even itself, Bukhari and Muslim, he gives also another story narrated through a companion of the Prophet by the name of Jabir ibn Abdullah. When somebody asked him what was the first to be revealed of the Quran, and he says it was chapter 74, that is not 96.
Yes.
But here again, the reconcilability is not really that difficult. Why? As Al-Qattan explains, maybe the question was about which chapter was revealed in full first.
Yes.
And that could be very reasonable because, as we said before, the chapter would not all be revealed in sequence. In other words, maybe chapter 96, and actually there are indications that chapter 96 was not all revealed in the same time, but the first few verses were revealed, and then other chapters were revealed, and then the completion of 96 Which means that the first complete chapter that came in the middle is the first.
Yes.
But not the very first, the first complete chapter to be revealed of the Quran. It's no problem with this. Or could it could be also that the question was understood by Jabir, or was intended by the one who questioned him to mean what was the first thing that was revealed after the initial period where the revelation was not coming to the Prophet? Because again, historians say that the first revelation came to him, and then there was a period where there was no revelation, and then it resumed again. So maybe the question actually was about what is the first after this initial period. So if these things are examined carefully, many times, I'm not saying 100% of the cases, many of these apparent differences can easily be reconciled. Just one more example that might clear that issue also. Al-Qattan also mentioned, for example, that there have been differences of opinion as to which verse in the Quran was the very last to be revealed. And some refer to, and notice the numbers, to chapter 2, verse 278. Mm-hmm. Some refer to chapter 2, verse 281. Some refer to chapter 2, verse 282. And as he says, you're talking about the same chapter, you're talking about, you know, a few verses which are very close to each other, which does not preclude the possibility that all of them actually were revealed at the same time. A whole section was revealed, but people, just to express what they understood, they might refer to one aspect of that, you know, group of passages. One would refer to this, but actually they're referring basically really to the same thing. But the basic point to be made here is that the very fact that you have this difference of opinion shows clearly there was no attempt, as some might allege, of trying to suppress any opinion, even if that opinion might not be well based, that there was this freedom of research and the scholarly study was open for all.
Well, in this type of study, were there any yardsticks which perhaps could have helped in the classification of the Meccan and the Medinian revelations?
Well, there are some basic criteria which, beyond even the verification of the reports, the narrators, and the story itself, that pertain to the subject matter and the, you might say, the orientation of both types of revelations, the one in Mecca and the one in Medina. Well, as indicated before, that the Meccan period was a period where Muslims were weak, they were few, they were constantly persecuted, they were hurt. So the emphasis in the revelation in that period was to help them persevere, tell them about patience, give them the hope that ultimately truth would prevail. There was no legislation at that time how to get into war, even with the unbelievers, because they were so few, they could not even engage in that kind of... So it was giving them the chance to inculcate the proper belief, faith in the Creator, in their hearts, to remember the nature of revelation, the hereafter, the punishment and reward, which was useful both for them as well as in addressing the unbelievers. Because you notice also in the Meccan revelation that the chapters are normally short. they are very strong in their, you know, style, as if they are shaking those traditions that people have grown up with. It appeared like they're strongly and powerfully shaking the ideas that has been predominant among people, awakening their conscience to the truth that has been concealed for too long. So this is one style. In addition to this general style, if you might say, of the Meccan revelation, we find that scholars also have spent a very great deal of time researching some of the other characteristics of the of that period. And you would be surprised about the accuracy and the meticulous research they did. For example, they noted that every chapter that includes a prostration, you know, in some chapters of the Quran, when it talks about prostrating to God, there is a sign you find in the side of the Quran, which means that when you recite that verse, you should react to it physically, actually, by prostrating and bowing to the Creator.
Yes.
You know, that's known as sajda.
Yes.
They found that all of these are actually in Meccan period.
Yes.
Okay. They noted also that almost every surah that begins with all mankind instead of all believers, not necessarily all of them, but in the great majority of them, seem to be the basic character of the Meccan,
yes,
of the Meccan revelation, because it addresses mankind, whereas in Medina you're addressing believers, yes, to teach them, yes, how to do their prayers and, you know, establish their community and so on. It was noted also that by and large in the Meccan revelation you find a great deal about the stories of different prophets in the past. You find stories about Adam and the temptation by Satan. The only exception perhaps to the mention of the stories of prophets and Adam in the Midianite, the other revelation, is just the second chapter, Al-Baqarah. But otherwise it's mainly the characteristics of that. It was also noted, for example, that the chapters in the Quran which begins with broken letters, alphabetical letters, we haven't touched on that yet, are all indeed in the Meccan period. Now notice the comparison. If you move on to the Midianite period in Medina, you find that first of all the broad character of revelation in that period was how to build a Muslim society, who finally found sufficient freedom to practice their faith in various aspects of their lives. And as such you find various aspects dealing with worship, with legislation pertaining to the family, to society and social relationship. Again, another interesting remark. In Mecca, hypocrisy was not very clear. You know, nobody really wanted to become a Muslim hypocritically because Muslims were already persecuted and weak.
Yes.
There was no motive. But now, as Muslims became more powerful and prominent in Medina, you find you find hypocrisy emerging, that some people just, you know, became Muslims because Muslims are powerful in Medina. And the Quran again discussed their designs and their attitudes. In Mecca, the population was mainly pagan.
Yes.
In Medina, you have people, so-called people of the book, who had been given scriptures before. And that's why you find that the Midianite revelation discusses various aspects of their belief and try to bring to their attention what was the true message given by previous prophets in the past and try to bring them back to the pristine, immaculate monotheism that all of these prophets taught. That does not exist, you know, in that form in the Meccan period. You find, for example, that in the Midianite period, this was the time when Muslims were attacked,
yes,
by the pagans and by the other allies of the pagans. So we find that the law pertaining to war and peace and what to do with prisoners of wars and all of these, mm-hmm, were legislated, which was not really needed. And as such, you have here a basis not only to say that, yes, some reports say that this was Meccan revelation and this is Midianite, but by careful analysis of content,
mm-hmm,
you can make sure in many respects, in most cases really, that this could not be Meccan revelation. It talks about jihad, it talks about almsgiving,
yes,
or zakat, to be more,
yes,
accurate. Zakat was not really mentioned that much, at least in terms of payment of regular,
yes,
money to the needy in Mecca, because Muslims were weak and they were very poor.
Yes.
So it was out of place.
Yes.
That shows that it was Midianites. This is a sort of distinction which, again, as indicated earlier, would be very, very helpful in understanding the change and gradualness of legislation, and reflection, help us to reflect actually on the divine wisdom as to why revelation took those stages,
mm-hmm,
into account.
Could I get you perhaps to comment a bit to illustrate this gradualness that you just mentioned in closing off your comment to the last question?
Like specific illustrations?
Yes.
Of that? Well, take for example the nature of the mission of the Prophet.
Yes.
On one hand, you find evidence, very early evidence in the Quran, that the Prophet was sent to the entire mankind. There's no question For example, in Surah 81, which is in one of the early Meccan revelation, there is mention of that. But in terms of the methodology or stages of invitation, you find that the first revelation in chapter 96 was basically, you might say, prophethood news to the prophet,
mm-hmm.
or indicating to him that God chose him,
mm-hmm.
Asked him to reflect or to read in the name of the Lord who mm-hmm. taught. But it didn't say go and tell others or invite mm-hmm. others. In the following stage, in chapter 74, you find that there is mentioned explicitly, the second stage, that it is not enough for you, O Muhammad, to realize that, you know, God chose you as mm-hmm. a prophet, but you're also a messenger, because it says "Qum fa'andir,"
mm-hmm.
get up and then begin your struggle to convey the message of the Lord. And the same thing for chapter 73 gives you the same kind of invitation. In chapter 26, you find that it moved to clarify again who to invite, and it says "Wa'anzir ashiratak al-aqrabin," begin with your close kin's
mm-hmm.
relatives. Why? Because of course these are the ones who know you best.
Yes.
And that's a logical beginning. In chapter 6, it talks about the Prophet being ordained to invite the people of Mecca in general and the township around it.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 21, it talks about the Prophet being sent to the entire mankind. So you see the gradualness,
yes.
the circle, variety of expanding circle
mm-hmm.
of invitation, even though, as indicated earlier, one of the earliest revelations say it's a common message of all the prophets, it's a universal message. Another aspect is that at the time when the prophet came, they used to drink alcoholics,
yes.
that is almost like fish.
Mm-hmm. It's great wine lovers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Wine lovers, very much so. They have lots of poems about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not been really possible to come all at once and say, all right, from now on, stop drinking. You need a period for detoxification.
Yes.
That's why, again, we find the Quran started first by telling them that, all right, even though they might feel there is benefit in drinking, there are harms, but the harms are more than the benefit. Second stage, it said, don't come to the prayers while you're under the influence of intoxicants, which meant, as we might have indicated in some program some time ago,
mm-hmm.
that since the Muslim prays 5 times every day and night,
yes.
and these times are closed, like early morning, like dawn, noon, afternoon, sunset, and night prayers, the period is so short between prayers that if somebody really wants to get drunk,
mm-hmm.
the only time you can drink is after the night prayer, so that mm-hmm. you might be sober enough
mm-hmm.
before the early morning prayer the following day. So that discouraged, and people got the message, they started reducing their intake. And then finally came the verse, of course, that irrevocably and totally, you know, prohibited all kind of intoxicants. So this is another reflection again, that in the divine wisdom, it shows us a model, it shows us an example as to how could you, if you wanted to change a society, not just to come by chopping hands and heads and think that you're doing the best thing that could be done, or you're implementing the will of God. It shows us that you have to be considerate, you have to be careful, you have to be gradual, and of course not in beliefs are not compromisable, but in
yes.
matters of personal habits
mm-hmm.
and correction of evil in society, one has to be gradual and careful.
Mm-hmm. Brother Jamal, another very interesting program. Unfortunately, we don't have time to continue our discussion today. We want to thank all of you, our viewers, for watching, and invite you back next week, and we'll continue our discussion of Quranic sciences. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. أشهد أن